Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. Happy to have you with us. But first, I want to tell you about one of the sponsors we have here on the show. The NFL draft is one of the most anticipated days of any football fan's calendar, and that also means fantasy football season is not too far behind. DynastySportsEmpire.com is going to change the way you play fantasy football. DSE offers fantasy football gamers of all skill levels an opportunity to draft and retain your well-maintained rosters and players for their entire NFL career. Highlighted with large rosters, high-scoring games, easy payouts, and an amazing online community, DSE has everything you would want in a challenging online experience. Please visit them online today at DynastySportsEmpire.com. That's DynastySportsEmpire.com. And check out all the amazing upcoming formats for this upcoming fantasy football season. Go check them out. We got a great episode for you today, so let's get to it.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hey everybody, thanks for joining the show here. Welcome to another week of Verbal Shenanigans. I wanted to do something a little different this week. One of the things we really are proud of here at the show is some of the guests we've had the pleasure of having on over the years. We have a whole bunch of new episodes coming out with new guests, but I thought it'd be cool to every once in a while throw a little Verbal Shenanigans classic at classic interviews at you guys. So today I chose two interviews to throw up there. I'm going to keep it short and sweet. First one is with John and Callahan Walsh, John Walsh of America's Most Wanted. It was just such an honor to talk to those guys. Just like such a staple of like Sunday night television and America's Most Wanted. And I never thought I'd get a chance to talk to a guy like John and his son Callahan. And then the second one I chose is like everybody's favorite nostalgic. He was like in our homes as a kid, and that is Mark Summers. So I decided to put both these up for people to check out, maybe for new listeners, people who haven't been around very long. So enjoy it. I certainly did. It was fun even just listening to these back. So I'm very happy to put them back out there again. So here they are. Enjoy. So I get excited for a lot of the interviews we do on the show, but I am particularly excited about this one. So Let's get the Walsh boys. That doesn't sound right. Let's get John and Callahan Walsh on the show.
Hey, Daddy, there. I am.
Hey,
Mike, you there?
John, Cal, how are you guys? Thank you guys so much for giving us a few minutes.
Glad to, and I want to offer my apologies for being unavailable before. It's just been, with the premiere of the show, it's been crazy traveling and media and all that stuff, and still trying to shoot shows for the end next week. So I apologize.
No problem at all. Thank you for taking the time out to talk to us for a few minutes here. So I guess the first question I really got to ask you guys, I guess this is more directed at Callahan first. Cal, you've watched, you grew up with your father with this massively successful show and purpose and, a life's purpose and so successful where it literally is ingrained in America's, everybody knows America's Most Wanted, and it's done so much good work. Cal, when did you kind of take on that mission and become involved and be inspired to do similar work to your father or now with your father?
Right. Well, I grew up watching my parents, found the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, an organization that I currently work at. That's my day job, that National Center.
Right.
An organization that's gone on to help recover over 280,000 missing kids.
Wow.
And do really great work in the exploited children arena as well. And I watched my parents battle up and channel their rage and their anger about what happened to Adam to try to prevent that with other families and try to recover other missing kids. I also watched my father, my whole childhood, you know, go on the road and try to catch bad guys. And I started, you know, volunteering at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children when I was pretty young, through elementary and high school. Sort of knew I would eventually make my way over there. But out of college, I actually went to work for my father at America's Most Wanted. He was a producer for a number of years. I had the mission-driven attitude. I just wasn't sure if I wanted to be on camera. I wasn't sure if that's the path that I wanted to take. And
right.
I helped co-create his last show, The Hunt, and after that was sort of felt like I was sort of out of television, and I was sort of over it, and made my way over to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, where, amongst other things, became one of their spokesmen. And so we started going out there and really telling our story and the story of the National Center and its incredible mission. And that's when I kind of realized, you know, I think this is something that I could take on, and just honored to be able to join my father in his new show in pursuit. Part of Discovery's idea to bring me on board and bring somebody in that could go it out on the field. I understand what these families are going through.
Mm-hmm.
I can empathize with them. And I know how to talk to law enforcement because of my work, both from America's Most Wanted and at the National Center. And so I felt like I was in a good position to be able to join my father and really take on that work. He's got huge shoes to fill.
Yeah.
Has set a really high bar, and just trying to do everything that I can to carry on that mission.
John, piggybacking on that, like, how does that – I mean, it's got to feel pretty amazing – obviously you know, turning a tragedy into so many good things, but now to get a second generation, like you know, working with your son, carrying out your mission that, you know, you started, you and your wife started, what does that feel like to be working together now?
Well, I think it's great. I think lots of families, work together in America. America's a country of, you know, mom and pops. 80% of America is mom and pop businesses, and there's always the family dynamics, etc. But I'm proud of Cal, and I enjoy working with him for a lot of reasons. I watched him mature over the years. He was always right there, you know, volunteering at our different fundraising events for the National Center. And then he went to Stetson University, did really well there. He's a world-class soccer player, and you know, he went and it's one of the few colleges, they call it the Harvard of the South, Stetson. It's in DeLand, Florida. Hard school to get in, tough school to stay in, but they have the only school in America that has, you can get a degree in family business. And that's because the Rockefellers were part of the different families that founded Stetson. So I was hoping that he would go into the family business because I was the executive producer and had my own production company for the 25 years we did America's Most Wanted. It was an amazing run. It proved to me that the American public and the world public, because we caught guys in 45 countries, and that they would do the right thing if you showed them how to do the right thing and not jeopardize their lives. So I came up with that concept of a hotline that answered the phone, not cops. But I always thought that I always wished that Cal would maybe join me. And then, you know, he went to work at the National Center, which was, he does God's work there. Anybody that works at the National Center, they have five branches, and the big headquarters are in metropolitan D.C., and 300-plus people work there. So I thought that was great, and I always said to him, Cal, you know, you're a good-looking, smart guy. You'd be good on camera. And he says, Dad, you know, I like every other aspect of it. The on-camera is tough. I'm not so sure that's the way I want to go. So he started, you know, getting coffees as an AP, worked his way up to be a really good field producer. He knows everything about TV. He just watched that machine of Walsh Productions create an hour-long television show 51 weeks a year for 25 years. So he's battle-tested. But, you know, it was actually ABC and Good Morning America that loved Callahan and said, you know, John, if you ever want to do a pilot for ABC, we would love to have Callahan as your field correspondent. I said, I think he could do it. And he did so many live hits on GMA that they went, this guy is battle tested. And so when I decided to come out of retirement at the urging of the U.S. Marshals, who've been my partners for years, and the FBI, talking about 2018, I went, wow, this is a this is an opportunity for Cal to do a lot of the legwork. You know, he grew up without me home. He and his brother Hayden and his sister Megan, my wife, virtually raised those kids who were born after Adam was murdered, still married to the same beautiful wife after 47 years. But she took great care of these kids, and I thought, well, maybe Cal can do the legwork. And he's very empathetic with victims. The media is brutal on victims. It's just the get. We got to talk to that person. Oh, they just got recovered, like Elizabeth Smart, and advised their family. This girl was kidnapped for 8 horrible months, tortured every day. Don't talk to the media. Don't be seduced by the talk shows.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to do that. So Cal has that empathy. He knows how to talk to these families, as Cal often mentions. He saw his mother and I suffer the 27 years it took us to get that, to get Adam's files open, because the Hollywood police would not let anybody look at them because of all the mistakes and the horrible job they did on Adam's murder.
Wow.
So he knows what it's like to look for justice firsthand, and he knows how to talk to cops. You know, the marshals were saying last year was the most deadly year for cops, 144 cops killed in the line of duty. And you never see anything in the media about wounded cops, paralyzed cops, all these cops. I mean, there's 14,000 plus names on the law enforcement memorial in D.C. of men and women who went to work one day and never came home, made the ultimate sacrifice. So cops don't trust the media, justifiably so. They're always looking for the next Rodney King beating. They're always putting down cops. Cops have the worst job in this country. And Cal knows how to talk to him with respect and say, look, you know my father, you know what this show did with law enforcement, and we're going to saddle up and we're doing a new show. So I watch how he talks to cops, and I'm proud to have him working with me.
That's great.
That's amazing. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about the new show? For what I read up on it, there's going to be some cases on there that types of cases that weren't even showed on America's Most Wanted. Can you kind of expand on what the show is going to be different from the original show, America's Most Wanted?
Well, it's going to be very similar. That's what Henry Schleiff, he's the president of ID and an old friend of mine. He's the guy that started Court TV and made it a big hit. And I had a half hour behind the scenes look at America's Most Wanted show called Final Justice. And he had it on Court TV. It was his number one show for 3 years. So I had a lot of history with Henry. And Henry said, look, I'm thrilled you're coming out of retirement. I have always wished that you would come on ID. That now Discovery has 25 channels. That they're the second biggest media conglomerate behind Comcast and NBC Universal. So he said, I would love to have you. So I said, Henry, I've been talking to the marshals and the FBI and about how violent America has become. Crime has gone down. That's personal crime, burglaries and car thefts and all that stuff. But homicides have skyrocketed. And they said, John, not just skyrocketed. 2018 was the most deadly year. We had 307 mass murders. That means four right. people or more shot at one Jeez. Time. 307 mass murders, 27 school shootings. And they said, and worse than that, John, the clearance rate for homicides in four cities, particularly Chicago, that has been breaking records for murders in the last 4 years. Chicago, Detroit, Baltimore, and New Orleans, the clearance rate is down to 28%. So people in those cities have a 70% chance to kill somebody, murder somebody, and get away with it. And we need your help. America has broken records. You're the guy that finds the uncatchable felons. And I went, okay, I don't have that big primetime budget. I've got a cable budget, but I'm going to make it look as much as like America's Most Wanted. We're going to do two missing kids every show. Cal's in charge of that, picking those kids from the center. We're going to do maybe put 4 or 5 guys on a show, because now we're turning down about 200 requests to do these different cases every single week. That's how hard-pressed cops are and how little resources they have. So how can America become the country of mass school shootings, mass murders, nobody getting caught for homicide? So we saddled up, and Cal's a good partner to saddle up with me.
It sounds great. It sounds, you know, like what you established so many years ago. It's like something that the country needs, like this ability to report things and see what's going on and whatnot. I wanted to ask you, John, like, so when you first, you know, after what happened with Adam and you first went on to television and created the show and the first couple episodes of one, was it very hard to go from, you know, a personal tragedy to all of a sudden actually, you know, having to be both informative, entertaining, and to be able to turn on that TV personality at the same time too? Was that a hard adjustment or did you actually find like a sense of purpose when you started the show?
Both. I never wanted to be in TV. I had worked very hard to create my own company. I had three partners and was very successful at a young age. I went through learning the hotel business, learning all about it, traveling all over the world. I had a great mentor.
Right.
And then he said, it's time to go on your own. So I met these three guys from Texas. We formed a company. We were doing phenomenal. We were building our dream project, a $26 million 300-room boutique, beautiful five-star hotel on Paradise Island, when Adam was kidnapped. And that kidnapping and murder just tore the hearts right out of my wife and I. But I couldn't work. I lost 30 pounds. I couldn't function. The hotel was way over budget. We didn't get it open on time to meet the demands. And I never went back to the hotel business. I was so angry at the FBI not entering Adam's case, refusing to do it. I started testifying before Congress, and Adam and Cal's mother answered. The Hollywood, Florida post office delivered about, they guesstimated, 40,000 letters to put in our garage of people all over the world and mostly North America who had missing children. Their ex-spouse in a divorce had kidnapped their kids and didn't get custody, was punishing them, or they were teenage runaways. Just it was a nightmare. So I started blasting through that anger and pain and heartbreak and thinking about suicide and wondering, how am I going to make a living? What can I do now? And all of a sudden, you know, we got Reagan to help us. Reagan was a great president. Bush Sr. was great. Congress helped us create the National Center. We got a few good things done, the Amber Alert and stuff. But in 1987, a producer stopped me in the Fort Lauderdale airport, and he said, you know, we've been calling you. Fox has been calling you. I go, what is Fox? And he's, I know you've been getting these calls, but I'm not interested in whatever you want to do. And he says, no, hear me out. We're starting a new network. It's on Sunday night. We have one program. It's very successful. It's with a young musician that we found in a club on Sunset Boulevard called Johnny Depp. And I went, never heard of Johnny Depp. He said, well, nobody has. He's a struggling musician. But it started by Rupert Murdoch. He's a millionaire. Rupert wasn't a billionaire back in 87. And we're trying to start a fourth network. There's only ABC, CBS, and NBC. And everybody says there won't be any fourth network. There was no streaming, no 1,000-channel universe, no HBO, no Netflix, no Hulu, nothing. And he said, we want to model it after Crime Watch UK, and it would be America's first reality television program. And I go, what is reality television? He said, well, in England, Crime Watch UK is a partnership between the government channel, the BBC, and Scotland Yard. And they do recreations of crimes very nicely, and they've caught some bad guys, and it's successful. And I went, okay, I don't know anything about television. I don't know who the hell Rupert Murdoch is. Nobody's ever heard of Fox or Johnny Depp. And I don't know anything about Crime Watch UK. I'm trying to change laws, going state to state, create the National Center. I turned them down for 6 months. And it really was Callahan's mother who said, look, imagine this, John. Adam's murder has never been caught. What if you picked a murderer to be on the first show? Maybe it only runs one show. I said, yeah, they want to do a pilot. And she said, what's a pilot? I said, I didn't know what a pilot is, but it's the sample first show. And they've only owned five stations, and they got about 30 other stations that are signed up. And she said, well, why don't you pick a child killer? And I said, okay. I went back to the FBI, and I said, here's the deal. I'm not coming to Hollywood. I'm not a Hollywood guy. I want this show to be based in D.C. because the marshals and the FBI, I've settled my scores with the FBI. They're on my side now. They're based in D.C. The National Center's there. And I learned one thing over these years. Nobody wants to call cops. I want my operators to take the calls. Cops will be there at the show, and I'll hand those tips over. But people are afraid of revenge and retaliation and all the stupid things. I don't want to get anybody in trouble or have any problems. Just tell me where the dirt bag is, and I'll take care of it from there. And they said, wow, for a guy that's never been in television, you got a lot of demands. I said, I'm a businessman. I know what I need or want. Take it or leave it. 1988, February, it's in the record books. It's in history. I profiled David James Roberts, a horrible guy from Indiana. He had raped 27 women and got out after 6 years on parole. While he was on parole, he killed four people, two of them small children. They caught him. He escaped from the Indiana prison. He was serving five life sentences. A buddy of his smuggled a gun. When David James Roberts said, I'm sick, I need to go to the hospital, his buddy had a gun at the hospital and he escaped. 2 years, he was at the top of the FBI's 10 most wanted. Serial killer, serial rapist, horrible guy. And that's the guy I put on the first show. And 3 days later, they caught him in Staten Island. And guess what he was doing? He was hiding in plain sight, running a shelter for the homeless, a sociopathic murderer, child killer. Mm. And the show that was, we started out with the toughest guy, the most wanted guy in America, and nailed him 3 days later. And the rest is kind of television history. 25 years we were on. And I got to tell you a coincidence. We had our first capture about 10 days ago. I picked the Marshall's 15 most wanted guy named Luis Frias, put him on the first show, caught him, first guy profiled, most wanted guy off the first show. Was incredible. That's caught him in Mexico.
Unbelievable.
So we're back on, back on the air trying to fight the good fight.
That's amazing. Crazy. I mean, when you hear stories like this, and I kind of want to have this question for both of you guys, both Cal and John. I mean, not to go off the subject, if you will, but dealing your whole life, obviously, with your own personal tragedies, and then hearing all these stories, working with cops, hearing all this stuff, are you able to kind of turn it off, for lack of a better term? Are you able to, like, go on a vacation and enjoy your life and kind of not think about the tragedies in this world, or is it still kind of hard to deal with all that's going on in this world?
It's a great question. I'm going to let Cal talk about his side of it, observing it, but I learned one thing. I had a great father. He was a hero father, died at 52 years old. And I didn't learn until after he died. He was a war hero, 15 medals. He quit college in his 1 month to graduate from Notre Dame. First generation Irish American, going to graduate from Notre Dame. Pearl Harbor happens and he settles up. He volunteers. And on his deathbed, I said, Dad, I've got a little son, Adam, here. He's 3 months old. You're dying. Can I name this boy after you? You're my hero. Tell me what, give me some great father advice. And he said, I'll tell you what, I know you love children like I did. Enjoy your children, because once they become teenagers, they're out the door. And I said, why did you saddle up and volunteer? He said, John, I want you to remember this your whole life. Evil prevails when good men do nothing. It was as simple as that. So that's where I got that mantra. And yes, I've learned over the years, I would fly home on a Friday, leave again on a Sunday, whether it was Cambodia or Pittsburgh or Chicago or London, wherever it was. And I'd come home. I'm a polo player, love horses, play competitive polo with Callahan and Hayden. Hayden, the youngest son, still plays with me. It's such a dangerous sport. It takes your mind off of it. But I've walked in the shoes of these people. I know what it is that have your heart pulled out. I know that there are lots of horrible, evil people out there who prey upon women and children because they're cowards. And I know they need to be caught because they never stop. It's a compulsion for pedophiles to keep molesting till they stop. So I separate it with the love of my family, a really dangerous sport that takes my mind off of it. And then when it comes time to go back to work and get on those planes, I do it. And I know that Callahan watched me do it for years, and he knows how much I respect women and love children. He probably has a different perspective, But I know how to relax, because you're no good if you're not in shape and if you're not healthy. You can't put up with the hours on the planes. You can't put up with the sadness. You can't put up with the long 12-hour days. But that's how I deal with it. Callahan may have a different way. Cal, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, it is difficult to turn off, right? I mean, children don't stop being kidnapped after 5 o'clock and on the weekends. And same goes with these perps. You know, we'll get a capture in the middle of the night and get the update. And so you're constantly being inundated with new information about cases you're working on or what have you. And so it can be difficult at times, because it isn't just a job that you can clock out and go home and not have to worry about it until the next morning. But like my father said, we were a big family that were always involved in sports. And athletics is a way to be able to channel not only some of the issues or frustrations you might be having, but it's also a great therapeutic way of just, you know, letting your mind go and diving into something that, you know, can really help take those thoughts away. And so for me, it was all sorts of sports. In high school, I was a triple athlete. I played football, soccer, and baseball. Later in high school, I started playing rugby, which I loved, and then polo as well. And so, you know, really just going out there and being involved in athletics, whether it's everything just from a regular workout. I mean, they talk about, you know, the runner's high, and that's, yep, it's a true thing. I mean, after you work out, you feel much better. You feel great. And so, you know, keeping your mind sharp but your body the same way is definitely a way that you can not only help relax but get your mind off some of those things that you may be, you know, dealing with on a regular basis. And, you know, both my father and I are big advocates of seeking professional help if you need that. It's something that we provide our victims at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. We know the power and benefits that it has, and so, you know, mental health is a huge issue that we're dealing with in this country right now. You know, gun control is one, but at the same time, you know, mental health is such a big part of that debate. And so, you know, seeking professional help is something that, you know, we're advocates of, that we use at the tools that we use at the National Center, and we know the power of it. And so, yes, it absolutely can be difficult to tune that stuff out, but there are ways to put your mind at ease and to be able to deal with those types of issues.
And every now and then we hit a home run. When we got Elizabeth Smart back alive after 8 months, J.C. Dugard after 22 years in the backyard of a pervert, when you catch Luis Frias or David James Roberts, that we don't do backflips, we don't celebrate with champagne, but we sit there and say, wow, this is good. This is the combination of the sacrifices we make. This is what we've done, and probably we've saved some lives. So there's that aspect of it, too.
Absolutely.
No, this really is amazing. But I wanted to ask you, this is kind of a question for both of you. Cal, I wanted to ask you first, with, you know, being younger than your father, obviously, and with technology changing and social media and video and cameras everywhere, I wanted to ask you first how, like, this new show does it work much better with all this technology that's out there and being able to connect directly to people before they even have to, you know, I can message you today if something happens. And then I wanted, after Cal answered, John, I wanted to know, you know, in 88, 89, 90, how much harder it was to get information quicker. And do you see like a very big difference between the shows so many decades later?
Yeah, you know, being a producer on America's Most Wanted towards the tail end of its career, you know, that's when social media was just starting to get legs. And we could kind of see that what was on the horizon, but it really wasn't as ubiquitous as it is now. It wasn't on everybody's phone, not everybody was using it. Now you can't get away from it. And so we're absolutely harnessing the power of social media, both for our missing kids and our perps. At the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, we know the most important tool when it comes to the recovery of a missing child is a photo of that child. And it goes the same way with our wanted fugitives. And so to get those images out of our missing kids or our perps that you see on the show, that's really what it's about. It just takes one person to see that image. And whether it's somebody on the show or somebody on social media seeing that image, they're oftentimes the linchpin in that investigation. They can be the key that unlocks the door to justice. They might just not know it. Right. So it's really about getting that image out there to as many people as possible. And social media really allows us to do that in one of the most inexpensive ways that possible. You know, we used to be known as the Milk Carton Organization at the National Center, right? But that's an antiquated way of doing it. It's really only about getting eyeballs on that image. You know, social media is definitely the way to go. And so not only getting those out there, but getting the tips in as well. Now we're taking tips online at InPursuitTips.com. We're really trying to lower the threshold. You know, not everybody wants to pick up the phone. We have a lot of people who, you know, are almost scared to make phone calls these days.
Right.
And so, you know, giving them that ability really makes it easy for them to be able to give us their tip and send that information. And so, you know, using social media, harnessing that power is something that we're doing at the on this new show. You know, I see a lot of different online campaigns for other, you know, nonprofits and well-intended campaigns, great missions. But you do see some, you know, people going, oh, what's the point in sharing this post? It's not going to, you know, feed this child, or it's not going to cure this cancer or what have you. But sharing a photo of a missing child or a wanted fugitive can actually be part of the solution. You are helping in that cause by sharing those images. So we continue to encourage our fans and our viewers to not only share the pictures of our perps that are wanted on the show, but share those images of missing children. You never know who's going to see them.
Yeah, and let me say, back in 1988, it was so hard. It was so frustrating. I saw firsthand how horrible the search for Adam was, how poorly organized it was. The cops had never had a missing child in that little town of Hollywood. They had no idea what they were doing. A lot of them cared. Some of them didn't. Some of them were just bothered. Oh, he's 6 years old. He's a runaway. My God, he's a six-year-old kid that lived in a beautiful house, brought to school every day by his mom and picked up every day. So those misconceptions, we got to wait 24 hours, 48 hours. My job was try to abolish those. But when I started America's Most Wanted, I went, look at the only thing we have are the in the post office. If you go to the post office, you'll see pictures of the FBI's 10 Most Wanted. There was no that's why I thought America's Most Wanted was such a great idea. To channel the power of television. Everybody watches television in some form or another. So we didn't have a website. We didn't have social media. We didn't have phones. We didn't have all the tech tools that we have now. And that really hindered Adam's investigation, because they had a suspect in 1984. There was no DNA. There was no DNA testing. They arrested the guy. He turned out to be Adam's murderer, but they let him go because they didn't have enough evidence to charge him. It broke our heart. We had to wait 27 years to open those files. And a really great cop that I had learned to admire and respect, who was retired and worked for me on America's Most Wanted, cop by the name of Joe Matthews from Miami Beach PD, and a retired prosecutor, Kelly Hancock from Fort Lauderdale, Broward County. Those two guys solved Adam's case in 1 month after we finally got the files open. They found all the mistakes that were made. It was just a nightmare waiting for 27 years to find out that the guy they had in custody and let go in 84 was the guy. And he probably committed 100 crimes after they let him go. He was caught 4 years before we got the files open, and he died on death row. But he of cirrhosis and AIDS, all the terrible things he had. But we never knew that. So now this tech world and all these innovations and inventions have become an incredible tool. Facebook is our partner. We can get an Amber Alert on a regional phone, not all over the country and burn people out, but in a regional area, you'll get an Amber Alert on your smartphone. You'll get it on your computer. You'll get it on Facebook. Immediately, our website is there 24/7. You can contact me no matter how inconsequential. You know, when I first started out, I would say to people, I still do it, I guarantee you, we don't trace your calls, we don't tap your calls, don't tell me who you are, don't tell me where you are, just tell me where the guy is. But it was so frustrating back in 88. I remember many guys I profiled, the hobo serial killer. He kept staying a week ahead of the show. He rode the rails. He was just a smart, illegal Mexican who came back and forth across the border. multiple times. He was arrested 17 times in America and let go each time. It was for shoplifting or a DUI or whatever it was. And he kept getting away, and he kept killing women. He was a horrible serial killer. But he stayed ahead of me every single week. We couldn't get the tips in enough time, in real time. Finally, his sister, who was working as an illegal maid in Los Angeles, said, I think that he's gone back across the border. But it took her weeks to get up the courage to call us. It took us a while to mount to, you know, the search and get the authorities. In Mexico is a huge supporter of this show. I have Spanish-speaking operators. But anyway, it was such a frustration. Now, yes, the internet, and Callahan and I talk about it, and cops all the time, what a dangerous place it is.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, it took us 3 years to shut down Backpage. Those dirtbags made $110 million a year advertising how to have sex with little girls, and pimps would pay for the ads. And we finally shut that down. So the internet can be dangerous. These guys aren't following school buses to kidnap people, although they still do it. But now they're in their hole in the wall trying to groom kids. Kid that is easily groomed, and meet that kid at the mall who thinks they're going to go meet another 12-year-old girl whose family's dysfunctional. No, it's a 45-year-old guy that lured her out. So the internet is stealing identity. You got Silk Road where you can buy guns and drugs and hire hitmen. The internet's dangerous, but it's a huge tool for me. It's a huge tool for Cal and I for In Pursuit, because we can get the picture out, get the latest information, get the tip enacted upon within minutes. The marshals, I still say, are the best manhunters in the world. They'll go anywhere to find, you know, bad guys. FBI's right behind them. But yes, the game has changed. It's a more dangerous planet. America has, I wish it was safer. It's way different than when I started this show. We might have turned down 50 cases a week. Cops weren't so overcome. And America's setting records with homicides. And you can be a psycho, paranoid, schizophrenic, go to a gun show, and you can buy a gun as long as you haven't got a felony. You could be 80% of the people who shot up kids in those 27 school shootings were mentally ill. Their parents, friends, family, schools knew they were mentally ill, but they still got their hands on guns. So there is so much to do, but last year was a groundbreaking number of homicides and dead cops. And you know what one of the cops said to me? He said, you know what's so frustrating, Mr. Walsh? We don't have the resources. We don't have the tools. Americans are more concerned with what Kardashian is going to be pregnant next, who's in the Super Bowl, when's the next movie. Nobody wants to care about this level of violence. We are the richest, most powerful country on this planet, and we are the number one in sex trafficking of children, number one in homicides, number one in personal crimes. We shouldn't be. We shouldn't have figured it out by now, but so frustrating.
As you brought up all your close relationships with the authorities and police, it's been very politicized. That if somebody supports, the cops or anything like that, or Blue Lives Matter, it just seems like a red button issue. I'm just wondering, what you guys would tell somebody who just frowns on the cops because it just seems like they don't get the support they need nowadays.
Cal, let me answer that. That's a great question. Okay, there are bad cops, just like there are bad podcasters, just like there are bad doctors. There is a percentage of cops who do bad shootings, and those cops need to be investigated immediately and pay for that crime. But the vast majority of cops are just hardworking families trying to make it through the day, trying to pay their mortgages, trying to pay their bills, take care of their children. They're just like all of us, and they have the world's worst job. And I say this to people, yes, cops, we should pay them better. We should pay them like we pay our stupid athletes. Last year, 30-plus guys in the NFL were arrested for domestic abuse and all kinds of crap. We pay them millions of dollars, and they still keep getting their jobs. A job that you go to work every day and your family and your kids don't know whether you're coming home or not, that's a job that should be better trained. Some cops go to a police academy for 3 months. Not in England. They go for a whole year. We need to train our cops better, We need to pay them better. We need to take care of their families when they're killed in the line of duty. And I'll say this. The next time a serial rapist breaks into your house, who are you going to call? What happens when that guy tries to carjack you out on the road? What happens if your child is kidnapped by a serial predator or your daughter is kidnapped by a Ted Bundy? Who are you going to call? You're going to call these people. I've been to these countries where there are no cops. I've been to Afghanistan. I've been to these horrible places and seen terrible things where the cops are all crooked. Like in Mexico, you can't find an honest cop because the cartels control them. They give them money, but they also tell them, if you don't take this money and tell us when you're going to intercede with it, or you're going to intercept a dope shipment or a bunch of young girls where the Sinaloa cartel's bringing across the border, we're going to skin your kids alive in front of you. So the cops are terrified. I've been in those countries where you can't rely on the cops. You don't know who to call. Trust me. People need to change their attitudes. We need to do better with our cops. We need to train them better. We need to pay them better. We need to support them, because on the outside, I was at Ground Zero, mm-hmm. and I was at Katrina, and for a couple days at each one of those terrible events, there was chaos. There was anarchy in New Orleans. Nobody was in charge. And all you have to do is experience that for an hour or for a day, and then you'll say, oh, my God, I really need to support my cops, because who the hell do I call when that guy breaks in my house in the middle of the night? So that's the reality.
Yeah, I mean, everything you hit on is dead on. You know, there's never this one answer. It's never black and white. You know, there's levels to everything. And you know, you hit on it as better training, better access to education and things like that. And there's always going to be bad seeds in it, no matter what profession you're talking about. I mean, thank God you found us bad podcasters. What would you do if
but I'll tell you, I've ridden with the best fugitive squads in America, and I've ridden with cops alone, no cameras, just to go with them. I say every politician ought to get off their fat butt and get out there and ride with a cop alone on 95 some night, or ride on an Indian reservation where there isn't a cop for 600 miles, where you pull somebody over and it's a bunch of dirtbag drug smugglers with 5 AK-7s and they shoot you through the door. It is the most dangerous, scary job on the planet. I've ridden in the worst ghettos in America, and I don't know how the hell they do it. I was riding with an ex-Marine from Afghanistan up in the Jacksonville, Florida ghetto. Really dangerous stuff. And he said, you know, Mr. Walsh, it is more dangerous here in this ghetto than it was the 5 tours I did in Afghanistan.
Yes.
I'm more afraid for my life, and I'm worried that I'm not going to make it home at night. But this is the job I love, and this is what I was trained to do. And he said, but it is more dangerous here than it is when I was in Baghdad in Iraq. And then I did 3 more tours in Afghanistan. I went, I see it. I mean, I've been shot at. I had a guy break my elbow. He jumped. A cop and I were riding alone, and he laid down on the ground, pretended he was hurt, and he split open the cop's head trying to get his gun. No backup, nobody around for 300 miles. And this dirtbag got up and smashed the log, broke my arm and all this crap. And I went, you know, we got him. We subdued him. Thank God he didn't get the gun and kill us. But every night I rode with these fugitive squads, they went, my God, this is a dangerous, scary job. And you got to make a decision in 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Do I kill this 6'2", 200-pound 16-year-old kid who's threatening me? Does he have a real gun? Is it a fake gun? Is he going to kill me? Do I get to go home tonight or do I kill him? It's the scariest, toughest job in America.
Guys, so John and Cal, first off, thank you so much for giving us a generous amount of time and, you know, being so open and honest. And it really, you know, I could talk to you guys for hours. So before we go, where can people check out the show? When does it air? What's the best way to say hi to you guys after they hear this interview? And two, I wanted to ask both of you, do you ever take the time to give yourself a pat on the back and to know how important the work you guys are doing? John, for decades, Cal, you know, you're you're coming out and being on this show, you know, like you were very personal setting this show up. We emailed back and forth. You're doing great work, and you guys are spreading a message that is obviously so important. And what's great about yours, it's not just a message, it's the thousands and thousands of people that your shows have, you know, put behind bars and solved cases and finished things. I hope you guys take the time, you know, to give each other a pat on the back or look in the mirror and say that, you know, you really, you know, yeah, you're on TV, but your TV show is doing so much good in this world. So I'd like to tell you guys that.
Well, Cal, you give them the tech stuff, and first I say thank you for the recognition, but, you know, I know one thing, and Cal and I talk about it all the time. Adam was the real victim, and I'm that angry, heartbroken father that's still out there. And I think that there are tons of good men out there, and unfortunately, we have to hunt down the bad men. So, you know, I love and admire the fans of America's Most Wanted that have transferred over to In Pursuit. We're doing good numbers, and I think those people understand the mission. I think they say, this guy gave us a way to do some good. He showed us a way to do it without jeopardizing our lives, without repercussions. And damn it, we're going to get online. We're going to get on the phone. We're going to go to that website, and we're going to give them a tip, no matter how inconsequential. And Cal, you can give them all the rundown of all of our positions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I grew up in a family that said we need to make sure that Adam didn't die in vain. If this song is to continue, we must do the singing. And so a capture of one of our perps or recovery of a missing child, that's the pat on the back that we get. That's what makes it all worthwhile, and meeting the families and be able to tell them, hey, we got justice for you. We brought back your child. That's really what makes it all worthwhile, and is really the payback that we need. And so it's just so great to be able to deliver that to families that haven't gotten the justice. It took 27 years to get justice in Adam's case, so mm-hmm. we know what that's like. There is never any closure, but justice is part of that healing process. So when we can provide that to a family, it's just amazing. In the new show, which, you know, we're trying to continue Adam's legacy in his name and continue that work at the National Center, but also on the new show In Pursuit with John Walsh. It's on Investigation Discovery Wednesday night at 10 p.m. You can follow my father and myself on Twitter at @John_Walsh, or you can follow me at Callahan Walsh. My father's got a great Facebook page that we're on regularly, posting new information and things like that. That's at John Walsh on Facebook. And then In Pursuit with John Walsh has a Facebook page as well, where we've got case updates. We have an after show that comes on at 11 p.m. following the 10 p.m. premiere. And so folks can go to Facebook / In Pursuit with John Walsh and go check out all the new updates and case information and things that we're posting there as well.
Cal, John, I want to thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for giving us the time, and we really appreciate it. And seriously, good luck with the new show, and you know, keep doing God's work out there, because you guys are you certainly deserving of it.
Absolutely, thanks. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for joining us for a few minutes. This is Scott Brennan here and Mike Berlow, and you're on the Verbal Shenanigans podcast.
Mike, how's it going?
It's going great, man.
Doing well, sir.
Just hearing your voice. It's
where are you guys based? Where are you out of?
We're in Jersey.
Oh, not far.
Yeah. Where are you, a New Yorker?
I'm in Philly tonight. I'm here for a few more days, and I'll head back to L.A.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. We're out of Philly. I don't know. We're not out of Philly. We're out of Jersey. But Mike is a big Philly sports guy, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fans here are out of their minds. I'm a Red Sox guy, and I thought the Red Sox people were crazy, but I think the Philly fans may have them beat.
We had to be number one in something, so it's just rabid fans.
Yeah, well, you win that, man. First time I went to a Phillies game wearing my Red Sox jersey, I had more threats to my life than I've ever had anywhere in my entire life. And one guy said, "You better take off that jersey." And I said, "Yeah, come on, man, I'm for the Red Sox." He said, "I'm not kidding you. Take it off." It's like, "Oh, okay, man." Yeah, right. So
he's like,
yeah.
"I double dare you."
That's right. You want to take the physical challenge, pal?
Ooh.
Mark, it's really awesome to speak to you for a few minutes here. Your voice is one that if you're a kid like my age, like, you know, grew up in the 80s and 90s, and even today, you've kind of like, we were just saying this before, you've kind of reinvented yourself so many different times along the way. But what I find really interesting is that you started in stand-up.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. And about the voice thing, it's always so weird to me. I don't think I sound unusual or different, but I'll be in a department store and somebody with their back turned to me will say, I knew that was you. I could recognize your voice. There must be something distinctive about it. I can't figure out what the heck that is. But, yeah, my two goals were to be on Broadway or to do stand-up comedy.
Right.
And so when I moved to Los Angeles in 1973, I had put myself through college doing magic, and I started to work at a place called the Magic Castle. And then I started to branch out into comedy clubs, but I was the opening act for other comedians. And I was opening for a comedian by the name of Gallagher at a place called the Laugh Stop in Newport Beach, California. And he said to me, Summers, I don't know how dirty you guys want to get, but he says, Summers, you're an asshole. And I said, why? And he says, every time you walk out there with a deck of cards, you get paid less money than the opening comedian. And I didn't realize that I was considered a novelty act. So because I was doing things with cards and coins and ropes, that the opening act as a comic was getting $300. And as an opening act as a magician, I was getting $150. Yeah. I went, well, I didn't know that. And so I slowly got rid of all the props and started to do stand up. And then I used to stand in line every Monday night at the Comedy Store starting in about 75. Wow. And became a regular at the Comedy Store in 76. And I was there sort of during the, you know,
the boom,
the days. Well, I was there with Jay and Dave, yeah, and Robin and Chandling and all those guys. We all started together. And, you know, the difference between me and them was they were funny. And I wasn't. And so I learned quickly that I was never going to be that good, and that, you know, hosting and being myself was kind of my forte. But, you know, I was there at the store from about 76 until maybe 79, and I continued to work the Magic Castle for years. I hadn't worked there in 30 years, and I went back about a year ago, maybe it's 2 years ago now, before I was doing the one-man show, because I just wanted to get, you know, some practice doing stage time live again. And whoa, you know, when you've been off stage for a while and you go back and do it, it's kind of frightening. But we did this one-man show in Bloomington, Indiana, and then we did it at the Adirondack Theater Festival, and I'm just having a ball. And then we got this documentary coming out in October. And, yeah, so I'm kind of a chameleon. You know, I just keep reinventing myself.
Now, just to confirm, was that the Gallagher who smashes watermelons who's questioning your props? Mm.
You absolutely are right. Leo Gallagher, that is his name. Absolutely. He used to be my neighbor. I used to live up in Calabasas, California, and he was my neighbor up there.
I imagine he was a loud neighbor.
He was
hammering away.
Absolutely.
Now, when you went from stand-up to, I know you have, like, disc jockey experience, and were you always just looking, were you, like, even as a kid, were you acting or in, like, plays or anything like that?
First show I ever did was Bye Bye Birdie. I must have been about 13 years old. I just wanted to be in front of an audience. There was something about live performing, and I had zero talent. I mean, I sucked at everything I did, but I just had huge balls, and I just kept, you know, going after it. And I started in Indiana doing, you know, stage stuff. I was a disc jockey when I was 15 years old at WBMP in Elwood, Indiana, when I left Dave Letterman, took my place. I've been doing this for, I am perhaps the only person I know in show business who never took a job in something outside of entertainment. I never worked at Macy's, and I never was a waiter. I've always worked in the entertainment industry. It's the only way I've ever made money.
Wow. I mean, as you going along, I mean, how far did you go before the opportunity came up with Double Dare? And did you see it being what it was to today as a nostalgia classic, or did you just say next job?
Oh, hell no. I didn't know what the hell we were doing.
How did they pitch that to you?
I was doing magic, and then I was doing stand-up, and then I talked myself into becoming a warm-up guy on TV shows. I lied to a guy at Mary Tyler Moore's company and told him I had done warm-ups. If he ever can't do one, to call me. And, you know, 3 weeks later, he called me, and I did that one. And then I started doing – I was, like, the king of warm-ups for years. I did Soap, Alice, Star Search, Webster, What's Happening Now. I mean, I did a ton of those things. And I was making six figures back, late 70s, early 80s, and it was the best-kept secret in town. And so when Double Dare happened, I wasn't even asked to audition for that thing. They had auditioned 1,000 people in New York, and they were coming to L.A. And they called a friend of mine from Indiana, Dave Garrison, who was a ventriloquist. And Dave called me one night and said, you know what, I don't think I want to perform anymore. I think I want to be a producer and go behind the scenes. So I don't know what this company is. It's called Nickelodeon. There's some show called Double Dare. Why don't you just go to the audition instead of me? And I went, yeah, sure, why not? I mean, I'll audition for anything. And, you know, I was the first guy to audition in L.A. And, you know, got 4 or 5 callbacks, and then I eventually got the job. And, you know, when we were doing it, it was, you know, more fun than I can begin to tell you. It was just, we just laughed our asses off 24/7. But did I think it was going to turn into what it turned into? Not in a million years. I mean, you can't even predict that stuff. No. But it just kind of, you know, for whatever reason, for a particular generation, that show just brings back fantastic memories, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I find it really interesting that you started in stand-up and even radio and acting, Broadway. You wanted to be on Broadway. It's all like nighttime things, but yet you found your wheelhouse in being a warm-up comic and doing a show that's on during the day and probably recorded during the day. You had the sweetheart gig, yeah. Man. I've worked with a few guys who do warm-up now, and they love it.
Oh, yeah. Well, now the pace, I mean, gee, I thought I was making great dough. Some of these guys make $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a night doing that, you know? So, yeah, you do 2 shows a week, you're in Fat City. It's hard to get into it. It's much more difficult. And by the way, now yes. It's just stupid. I mean, when I did it, you actually had to be good. Now, you know, they order in pizzas and they throw out candy and, you know, they do all this crap, which I would have never done. But to keep people, you know, interested in a show for 4, 5, 6 hours, when I worked on soap, sometimes we didn't get out of there till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and need to keep people there, and it's brutal. I mean, you earn your money. There's no question about it. And
right.
And by the way, I was doing fine back in the day. I was making $2,000-$3,000 when that meant something. You know, and I was working, let me think about this. I was doing Our Magazine Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I was doing Star Search Wednesday and Thursday night. On Friday night, I did soap or Webster. Saturday and Sunday, I did game shows. Monday, I had off. Tuesday, I did Alice.
Wow.
At CBS, and Alice paid the best. When I left that show, it was easy to do because they did one rehearsal that they taped, and then they would go through the show. You know, you go to a sitcom sometimes, it'll take you 5, 6 hours. We used to shoot that thing in less than an hour, and they paid me $800 a night. So I'd walk on stage at 7:15, and by 8:30, I'd be in my car going home. It's like, you know, stealing money. It was fantastic. Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, when you did stand up and you were like forming an act and whatnot, were you a clean comic, or did you just?
Oh yeah.
Oh, you were. Always.
I always work clean. Yeah, I always work clean because I knew that's where the money was. The goal obviously is to get on the Tonight Show or something like that. And
right.
They used to refer to me as the accountant comedian. I was the only comedian who was married at the time. I wore like corduroy suits and ties, and you know, I was like the only normal guy. I was hanging out with some of the most whacked out human beings you'd ever seen in your entire life, and I was just kind of this normal. You know, if you know who David Brenner was, I did that kind of, you know, 7-Eleven supermarket, you know, what did you get this in the mail today? I was super conservative.
I mean, it looked like you were above the curve, if you will, and all, with all these people. It's amazing so many guys are trying to look for that niche, and you just kept on finding a new way and knowing what it was before it was, you know, the norm.
You know, you got to move forward. You know, I lecture to colleges all the time, and my opening line is, nobody got up this morning and said, I got to go get Mark Summers a job today. You're responsible for your own happiness. And if you ever think there's an agent out there who, A, cares about you, or B, can get you a job, you're out of your mind. I never had an agent in 40 years ever give me a job. Right. They may have negotiated good deals for me, but I was the one who got all this work. So, you know, all these guys who sit back and hope that something's going to happen, you're never going to make it. You must take charge of your own career and your own life. Otherwise, forget about it, because nobody cares about you. It's just the way it is.
Now, Mark, you've worked on so many different, game shows, if you will. Is that like, I know it's a certain skill in itself, but is that like a lot of people, like I hear, like that came from either acting or stand up and get the game show gig. They say it's like a sweetheart of a gig, because it can keep going and going and can be multiple times a week. Like, is that something you were striving for, to continuously do, like the hosting game shows, Did that just kind of find after you did one?
No, Barker was my idol. I used to come up from nursery school and watch Through the Consequences when it was on NBC. And my first job in television, real job, it was as a writer, as an idea man on Truth or Consequences the last year Barker did it. So, you know, there I was, like, I thought I'd gone to heaven, sitting there working with Barker and, you know, going to the lunch truck with him every day and hanging out, finding what a right-wing conservative crazy man that he was, you know, was pissed off that Nixon was being prosecuted and kept telling me Nixon was the best president in the history of the world, all that stuff. I mean, Bob and I had opposing points of view then and now, I'm sure. But, you know, putting that aside, no, game shows were something I really wanted to do. And to be a good one, it's not, you can't phone it in, you know. People say to me, well, where were the cue cards on Double Dare? There were no cue cards. It was all in my head.
Right.
You know, I had to be able to describe a physical challenge in 15 seconds or less. You know, here's the object. What you have to do is you have to toss the ball over there and get it in. You know, if you do it in 30 seconds or less, you're going to get 40 points, whatever. You had to describe it, get it across, make sure the kids understood it. It was fun and it was entertaining and they were laughing. And I've hosted somewhere over 25 shows at this point now, and each show is different. I mean, I did a horrible show for Game Show Network called Wintuition, which really sucked. The production company had no idea what they were doing, and we were supposed to shoot 40, and they ran out of money. We did like 32 or something. I mean, I've had all sorts of stories, but when you've been in the business this long, that stuff just happens, you know?
I guess one question I really want to ask, maybe it's Double Dare or one of the other shows, was there ever like a contestant or a family that was – you just way too intense for the show where you almost like had to tell them to calm down during the commercial break?
Oh, yeah. When it became Family Double Dare and we were on Primetime Fox and we were giving away cars, parents became just insane. And, you know,
they would always ruin everything.
Throats and, yeah, well, you know, exactly. And so it was in its best form. It was when it was kids against kids.
Right.
As soon as you get a father up there who, you know, gets pissed at their kid because they missed the flag on obstacle number 7 and he's not going to get the station wagon, you know, I mean, it kind of took the fun out of it. So, you know, it's a freaking game. Calm the you-know-what down.
Oh,
you know?
God. Yeah, I coach high school sports, so I could just see Double Dare nowadays. Like, just seeing some of the parents on the sideline, I could see riots happening.
You
like,
want the flag or don't you?
You want to come home tonight?
Yeah.
You want dinner?
Find that flag and peanut butter sandwich!
Yeah, I coached my son's Little League baseball team for 8 years. I got stories you wouldn't believe, man. People are nuts.
Now, Mark, how did you... after the Nickelodeon days kind of died. Now, I know you like executive produce and, you know, a lot of different stuff. But you made your way over to Food Network. Now, were you a guy who was into the culinary world or into that? Or
no.
Did they kind of grab you as, hey, you're an awesome host. Come on, do this.
I went in and I was trying to produce a show and I was pitching a woman by the name of Roseanne Gold who'd won like 3 James Beard Awards. And I wanted to produce her show, and all the time she's in the room with me, they're saying, what about you? Why don't you host something for us? What about you? Why don't you host something? I said, I'm here trying to pitch this show. And they had done their homework and found out that I had this huge following, and they had a feeling that the people who grew up watching me would follow me over. And through a series of right time, right place things with a lady by the name of Judy Girard, who was my former boss at Lifetime when I was hosting Biggers and Summers, and in our home became head of programming, and I called her, and one thing led to another, and the first show I did was a show called It's a Surprise. It was a show about surprise parties, and the surprise was nobody was watching, so they canceled it. But I ended up doing Unwrapped, which has become the longest-running show in the history of the network. And so I've been lucky, you know. I wasn't a one-hit wonder. I did a bunch of shows, but I helped launch 2 networks, you know. I put Nickelodeon on the map with Double Dare and What Would You Do, and certainly with Unwrapped at Food Network, and then I've been exec producing both Dinner and Restaurant Impossible for the last 10 or 12 years. So it's been a bizarre career. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up, and you couldn't, plan this in any way, shape, or form. Stuff, you know, life is what happens when you're making other plans, but, you know, in show business, other people control your life. So you kind of have to follow the flow and not get too upset or not get too wrapped up and just kind of keep moving forward, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and now you even made it to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. I mean, that's got to be...
Boy, that's it. I can die and go to heaven now.
Yeah. But the next time a Phillies fan threatens you, you just throw it in their face. They're like, oh, my bad. You're good.
Yeah. You're good with
this guy's
you're
safe.
Good, you're good with us.
This guy's safe.
You're good with us. But, yeah, I mean, you're saying you have this silly career or whatever the word you were used, but I mean, people would want, anybody would die to do one of these things, have them on their resume. And it's just really cool to see you constantly find, you know, you're still yourself, but doing, whether it's different content or like going from slime to food is a pretty interesting transition.
Weird.
But, you know, I think it's that steady delivery and being able to host and engage with the public that I think is what, you know, people like about you.
Well, what you see is what you get. I'm no different off camera than I am on camera. And, you know, I just continued with my head down and moving forward. And look, I've been very lucky. I always say the harder you work, the luckier you get. But, you know, I've never really worked a day in my life. I've just enjoyed every moment of this, and it's been so much fun. And, you know, I don't know how people go to work every day if you hate it. You know, if you work in a, you know, a quarry or, you know, a large department store and insurance company, you get up every morning and go, oh, Jesus, do I have to do that today? But every morning I get up, I go, I get to go play TV today, you know? And so it's been so much fun. Yeah, there's some days that are more difficult than others, and you've got a crazy contestant or, you know, the cameras aren't working or whatever. Compare that to what other people do. I have nothing to complain about. It's been fantastic.
Now, it's also been well documented. You come out, talked about your having obsessive compulsive disorder. When you were going through any of these shows, was there anything that you did that you were worried that would trigger anything, or did you just had to go into it and say, I'm doing this and that, and kind of calm your mind to prevent any kind of allow you to continue with hosting or anything that you're doing on TV?
Yeah. You know, I'd waited so long to become successful, and I didn't get my first real national show till I was 34. Believe me, I wasn't going to let anything screw it up. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, certainly when I auditioned for Double Dare, I had no idea what it really was. And the first day I walked on the set and saw the obstacle course, I went, what the hell's this? And they said, well, you know, the kids run through 8 obstacles and get messy. And I went, you know, you really think they're going to want to do that? You know, I had no idea. And so, yeah, I wasn't going to let anything get in my way. So, yeah, I was able to overcome all that stuff. You know, what drives me nuts is because, you know, back in the day there was no internet. You know, people read this stuff down, make up their own stories, you know, hated every moment of it, this and that. It's like, that's such BS. I loved every moment. I you know, defy you to look at any time during the show when I wasn't enjoying myself. It's just, you know, it was overcoming something, but it was my own personal struggle. It had nothing to do with the quality of the show and what we delivered to the public, you know.
Right. I mean, I've also read that you even helped with, like, different nonprofits of, like, helping people with different disorders, or behavioral things. Do you still continue to do that kind of work today? Or
I do. As a matter of fact, I was just consulting 2 days ago. I've done interventions with people with various disorders, and I host a lot of charity events on the board of Alex's Lemonade Stand in Philly.
Nice.
I mean, I'm actively involved in all that stuff because you got to pay back. You know, I mean,
right.
I've been so fortunate that you're a real a-hole if you don't, you know, contribute back. And so, you know, the hard part is learning to say the word no, because the reality of it is you could do, you know, 2 charity events a night, 7 nights a week. And so as I've gotten older and more tired quickly, I don't do as many as I used to.
Right.
But when I lived in Philly full time and I got a phone call, I think I said yes 99 and 44 100% of the time. I'm more bi-coastal now, and I travel still a lot. I'm on the East Coast, I'm on the West Coast, so it's not as easy. But if you book me soon enough in advance, chances are I can make it happen, you know.
Awesome, man. I mean, so what's going on now? Like, I know you said the documentary's coming out. What's the story with that?
Yeah, that comes out. Well, you know, I did the one-man show, and then a couple of kids who grew up watching me on Nickelodeon decided they wanted to do a documentary on me, and I turned them down twice. A very bright kid by the name of Matt Klickstein, who wrote the book Slimed, all about the history of Nickelodeon, and a kid by the name of Josh Yawn, who very successful production company based out of the Houston area. And they put a team together. They shot this behind-the-scenes thing. I didn't know what to expect. They just killed it. It's fantastic. I had nothing to do with putting it together. They did it all. We open October 8th in Los Angeles, then New York City on the 12th, Philly on the 13th. Then we go to Austin, Texas, Baltimore, where Pat Sajak is going to be doing the Q&A afterwards. And we close in Chicago, and then, you know, eventually we'll sell it to Netflix or somebody like that. But, you know, I just... I have the attention span of a gnat, and I just, you know, want to do new things, and live performing is back where I want to be. And so, you know,
return to stand up.
Well, I don't know about that. No. The theater is more my
no, no. Gallagher already told him no. Yeah, so.
I was going to say, I got a vent. I run a monthly show if you want.
I got to tell you, there are very few people make me laugh these days. And, you know, I watch the younger comedians, and I'm not sure what anybody's talking about or what they're doing. So I don't think it's my world anymore. But, you know, I'm just having fun. You know, I'm trying to slow down a little bit.
Right.
I'm freaking old, guys. You know, I'll be 66 in November. You know, how much longer can I keep running around like a madman like this? But, you know, I have a grandson now, and I like to hang out with him. And pretty soon he'll be doing baseball, so I'm going to want to coach him as well. And, you know, my wife and I have fun. We travel, and, you know, it's all good.
Have you been on TV for so long and doing the hosting? Have you thought about doing any kind of, you know, helping people out, or did you have to do that a lot being executive producer in some of these shows to show people how to be a, you know, a quality host and entertain people?
Oh, I do it all the time. I've been hired by several networks to help train people. I mean, listen, I've had three great students. My first one was a guy by the name of Ryan Seacrest. I met him when he was 19 years old.
Oh, I heard of that guy.
And he's in my movie and says very nice things about the skills that I taught him were what made him be able to do Idol, which was very kind of him. And then my next subject was a guy by the name of Guy Fieri, who probably has every show on the Food Network now. And then Robert Irvine, you know, those are three of the guys that I've trained.
So anybody that we would know.
Yeah.
No, but not anybody. You know, Chris Rock's brother does comedy. I was hired to train him how to do a host over on Oxygen at one point. So people hire me to do that as well. And it's kind of a fun thing. But it's hard to teach somebody.
Right.
The natural instincts of, you know, certainly Seacrest and Fieri probably have the best instincts of two people I've ever worked with in entire life. I was producing a show for Spike TV called Ultimate Revenge, and I had hired Seacrest when he was maybe 23, 24 years old. And he was brilliant back then. I mean, he just was scary good. And Fieri, I mean, I've never seen anybody as natural and as likable as Guy Fieri on camera. So, you know, I was there and I helped guide them, and they were nice enough to listen to me. But these guys were going to be stars whether they met me or not. That had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at your career of doing all these things within the public and being a public figure, now what do we know, like, not know about Mark Summers when the cameras turn off and there's no hosting to be done, there's nothing? What is, like, something we don't know, or something that we would never know you're into, or how you spend your day? I know you said you had your grandkid. I'm sure that definitely takes up some time. But what don't we know about? What are you into on the side?
I'm the most boring human being you've ever met in your entire life.
Not true. Not true. My co-host is.
Hey, I'm taking this course. Just watch.
I like walking. Last summer, I went to Tuscany and Umbria, and I did 70 miles in 6 days. The one I'm going to do next is going to be somewhere near Normandy in France. So doing long...
This is like road walking or hiking? Or
yeah, basically road walking.
Okay.
Yeah, and going up through mountains and things like that. So I love doing that kind of stuff. You know, I'm just dull as whale poop. I'm trying to think of anything that's interesting about me, but I just can't think of anything. You know, I'm just an old guy who played TV for many years, and I love and appreciate celebrities. I hang out with all these young kids on Broadway. The kid who wrote my show, Alex Brightman, starred in School of Rock on Broadway last year. Drew Gasparini, who did the music, is writing a Broadway show for Warner Brothers called Night Shift now. I love hanging around these young kids, and they take me with them, and I sing at Studio 54 Below in New York. I go to Joe's Pub and work with them. I'm going to be doing a showcase with some guys in New York in February at 54 Below. So, you know,
you sound like a real boring guy, Mark. Yeah. Yeah.
I really, you know, I just do what I want to do. I just, you know, I don't know. I don't know that anybody cares, but, you know, I live performing is the best thing in the whole world. I collect albums of performers, but I only like to collect live, you know, like Sinatra Live or Billy Joel Live or all that stuff. Studio produced albums bore the hell out of me, so I do that stuff.
You know, you into vinyl? Yeah, are you into vinyl? Or are you in?
I am. I like the sound of it so much more.
I love it.
I grew up with.
I also think there's something to it. I don't know. It's in the living room spinning. I don't know. I don't know what it is. Even if the sound was like the exact same, there's just something about seeing it and placing the I don't know. There's something very tangible about putting the needle into the groove. I don't know.
I agree.
I don't know.
I agree.
It's amazing how big it is again. Vinyl is as big as it ever. Like it's almost bigger than ever because now these bands are releasing it once a year on Record Store Day. Like all these like expensive vinyls too. So I don't know. I like it.
Pretty weird.
Now it's. You've been in TV for so long. Is there anything you wish you could have done or looking forward to doing or anything you can sit back and go, damn, I could have?
You know, when we all started the Comedy Store in the early to mid-70s, we all thought we were going to take Johnny's place. Of course, Jay got that job. And then I got into news. I was on the home show on ABC. I was covering the Gulf War and the Polyclast kidnapping, and I was doing real serious stuff. I mean, I did a live town hall meeting on ABC Network, and, you know, I was kind of going in that direction. And so I've been a chameleon. At one point, I thought I wanted to, you know, I've been on the Today Show since 1986, for God's sake. I've been on The View since 99. So I've been doing these shows for years, you know. And I, the thing that's kind of fun is some of the people who are, you know, big celebrities today who grew up and watched me sort of treat me with reverence, which is so bizarre, but they're so complimentary about my body of work and what I've done and what a pro I am and this and that. And it's nice to hear that stuff, that anybody watched, anybody cared, anybody, you know, kind of observed and thought, well, you know, the coolest thing for me is when I go into a radio or TV station and the DJ or the personality will say, the reason I'm doing what I'm doing is because of you. Looked like you were having so much fun back in the day on Nickelodeon and I wanted to have that same kind of fun. And man, if that came across, then, you know, I'm happy as a pig and you know what. So, I have no complaints. I really don't.
Awesome.
Hey, Mark, one of the coolest things for us is being able to reach out to someone like you. And be able to sit down for a half hour and talk. So I really appreciate your time.
No problem.
I'm glad to hear the health is doing well. Two, what are you currently working on? Where can people go to say hello and maybe they heard you or just drop a line and check out what you're doing?
Well, you go to MarkSummersMovie.com, MarkSummersMovie.com to find out all about the documentary and the cities we're going to be going to in October. I just sold a new project with Guy Fieri and my friend Brian Lando, and that'll start on Food Network in December.
Awesome.
I tell you what the title is, but the network hasn't told us what it is yet, so we're waiting to do that. I got a little project going on over at HGTV that we're shooting in about a week or so, and hopefully that'll go to series. So, you know, I have my fingers in various pies. I still like producing, but, you know, given the choice, I'd always rather be in front of the camera or performing somewhere. You know, I'll probably do this another 4 years, and then at 70, shut it all down and, you know, just go, you know, romp the horse naked or something.
Well,
there you go.
Hey, once a week.
I'll have plenty of time.
Yeah. Once a week. Once a week. Me, you, and Mike.
I'm shocked you added me.
Why not?
Yeah, well, Mark, you've been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, man. And good luck with everything you got going on.
Hey, thanks for giving me the time. You guys have a nice evening.
All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed both those interviews. They're two of our favorites in the vault, if you will. And I'm glad to kind of bring them back to life and let new listeners hear them out. Thing is, what's cool about that is we're joining a new podcast network called the Podcast City Network. So hopefully you new fans, if you're checking this out, got to enjoy and see what we do. So that's John Walsh and Callahan Walsh and Mark Summers. So other than that, guys, please check us out on basically every podcast platform. Go leave a review if you dig what you hear. And other than that, guys, we'll be back with all brand new episodes coming up starting next week. So hope you dug what you hear. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.